Ferris B'nai Torah presents The Shmooze, an engaging and motivating Mussar and Hashkafa series that deals with real-life issues.
History, as it was supposed to be laid out, was radically changed, and not only for that generation, but for eternity. The course of events, the course of Jewish history, and the course of humanity's history was changed by one event, and that is the chait of the Meraglim, because the way the plan was supposed to be, the Jewish nation was supposed to go from Kabbalah Satorah, from receiving the Torah, we were supposed to go into Eretz Yisrael, and that kibush, that conquering of Eretz Yisrael, was to last for eternity. Had in fact that happened, had in fact we entered into Eretz Yisrael immediately, that type of kibush could not have been undone. There would have been no destruction of the first base of Mikdash, no destruction of the second base of Mikdash. The entire process of exile, of Golus, the entire history that we're now experiencing would not have been. The pivotal point was the Meraglim. Hashem told Moshe, pick out 12 people, 12 Anoshim, 12 men, 12 great men. These people are supposed to go into Eretz Yisrael, look at the land, get a sense of it, and come back. Interestingly enough, 10 of those people had a major chasaron, whether it be in betochen, and whether it be in their own sense of importance. Only 2 of them remained kosher, Yeshua and Kalev. And we get a little insight into what actually happened by a description of the pasuk. The pasuk says, "Vayalu b'negev," all 12 of them went up south. "Vayavo ad Chevron," and singular, he came to Chevron. Now Rashi notes the distinction. All of them went up south, and just he alone got to Chevron. Says Rashi, that's actually referring to the Gemara in Sota, Kalev Levad Halach Sham. It was only Kalev alone who went to Chevron. Menishtatech al Kivri Avos. He laid down on the kever of the Avos, and he was mispalel. He davened Shaloya Nisus Lechaveruv, that he shouldn't be pulled into the Eitzah, into the advice, into the trap of his friends. And that's why he alone went to Chevron. Rashi is paraphrasing the Medrash. The Medrash says that he literally lied down on the kever and was mavakish, Avram Yitzchak Yaakov, please have rachmanis, please have mercy, and please protect me from being drawn into their plot, from being drawn into their ideas, please save me. And that's what Rashi says, and that's the Gemara and the Medrash. The question that begs being asked on this Medrash is the fact that clearly Kalev got it. He knew what we were dealing with. The issue that was being discussed, the issue that he was afraid of being drawn into, was an outright rebellion against HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What the Meraglim came back with was a report that quite simply stated that Hashem is good, but not that good. Because this land is occupied by giants, and this land is an Eretz Ocheles Yoshveh, and even though Hashem may be strong, but there's no way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu could bring us into this land, we will die, man, woman, and child. Let's not do it. In plain language, it was apikorsis. It was heresy. And it was a major rebellion against HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that report spelled the death of that generation. That entire generation who were Makabalit had to die in the Midbar. And needless to say, the Meraglim who brought back that report died a very Misa Zara, very unusual, rather weird death. So Kalev understood this. Kalev understood what they were doing was wrong. He understood what they were doing was tantamount to rebelling against Hashem. And the question that begs being asked is, if he got it, why was he mispala? Why did he daven that he shouldn't be schlepped in? Meaning, if his tefillah was, please help me succeed in convincing them otherwise. Please help me in stopping them from speaking that way. Please help me in stopping them from being accepted by the Klal Yisrael. That would have been an understandable tefillah. What he's saying is, I get it, they don't. maybe the Jewish people will be schlepped after them. Please help me. But that was not his tefillah. His tefillah was a personal tefillah. Avos, Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, intercede, be mevakesh rachamim, beg Hashem that I should not be schlepped in, that I should not be convinced that their way is right, that I should not be sucked into their eitzah, that I too should not rebel against Hashem. And the question is quite obvious, and that is if he got it, if he understood A, the gravity of the situation, and B, he understood clearly that what they're doing is absolutely, utterly false, what did he need to be mispallel for? He knew it, he got it, the tefillah seems to be a tefillah shav, and he doesn't seem to need it. And I'd like to see if we can answer this and get a better understanding of what Kalev understood. And to do that, I'd like to focus this evening on a war that's been raging in this world, actually in this continent, for over 100 years. The war that's been being fought, that's raging, has a very, very high price tag. Thousands are gathered on each side. There are literally fortunes that are being waged, and it's being fought on a daily basis. And that war, as you may know, is the cola war. The war of Coke versus Pepsi. Now, as you know, Coke was began in 1886. Pepsi was began in 1898. And what they're fighting about is not a small thing. The soft drink market in this country is worth $68 billion. Market share is divided by very, very small percentages. A two-point swing in market share is worth well over $1 billion. And the result is that Coke and Pepsi on advertising spend more than many third world countries have in their entire economy. Because what they're doing is battling for primacy, battling for dominance, and across the billboards, across the airwaves, across print ads, you and I are exposed to this on a daily basis. Now, that being the background, here's a very important observation to bear in mind. And that is that Pepsi tastes better. And that's not my thought, that's not my observation. That's a proven fact that Pepsi really uncovered and released to the public starting back in 1971. You see, what Pepsi did was they realized that more people prefer Pepsi over Coke. And as of 1975, that became their dominant theme, that they would go into shopping centers, they would go into malls, they would go into supermarkets, set up a table, set up two cups, no markings on the cup. One, in fact, would be Coke, and one would be Pepsi. They would ask people to do the taste test. Invariably, more people preferred Pepsi over Coke. Since 1975, there have been a lot of years that have passed. You would assume that clearly since Pepsi tastes better, and it's been proven time after time that it's more popular, that Coke would be out of business by now, 30-something years later after the great discovery. Yet amazingly, Coke is not out of business. Coke is by far the dominant leader. 42% of that market is owned by Coke, far more than Pepsi. And the question is why? If more people prefer Pepsi, if Pepsi tastes better, why is it that Coke dramatically outsells Pepsi? And to understand that, I'd like to spend just a moment on a basic introduction to a 100-year evolution in advertising. In the beginning of the, let's say the 1901s, the 1902s, the beginning part of the 20th century, marketing and advertising consisted of features and benefits. A feature is our three-legged stove burns wood, not coal, therefore it has a certain advantage. The benefit is you don't have to get coal delivery, you can get wood from your backyard. Any product that was sold in that time period, the advertising, the marketing, spoke about the features of it, our quality product, our good thing, the benefit to you as a consumer. An interesting discovery came to mankind somewhere in the 40s. You see, what marketers began doing was they would market their products the way they always marketed their products. They would go to a given area, let's say Omaha, Nebraska, and they would figure out how many housewives between the age of 21 and 35 live in this area. Then they would go out nose counting. They would go out and do actual market surveys and ask these women the following question. If we were to bring to market a three-legged stove for under $249, and it was better quality, looked nice, had a good eye appeal, would you purchase it? Women would say invariably yes. Then they'd bring that stove to market, and nobody bought it. Even the women who said yes. And what marketers quickly discovered was something that was paraphrased actually an advertising age at the time that says as follows. In very few instances do people really know what they want, even when they say they do. And what marketers quickly discovered was that the fickle nature of the consumer is such that you cannot sell features, you cannot sell benefits, because that's not why people buy products. And what they discovered was people buy products based on how they feel about that product, the image that that product conveys, the sense that a person has about it, the prestige that that product conveys, but not the features and not the benefit. And if you study all of advertisements today, you see very, very little mention of the features or the benefits of the product. You hear an awful lot about the social image. Nike will make you athletic. And that's what they're selling. They're selling athleticism. When you see the pictures, when you see the image, that's what you see. Budweiser is selling popularity. Our beer will make you a popular fellow. This car is not for everyone. Is not a good way to sell the features or the benefits of this car. When you say the words, this car cannot be afforded by everyone, this car is not for everyone, what you're doing is you're selling a certain snob appeal. But that appeal is very, very elusive. It's an image, it's prestige, and that stuff works. Amazingly, if you study the ads of Coke and Pepsi, watch the evolution. In 1904, the theme tag of Coca-Cola was Coca-Cola satisfies. In 1906, the drink of quality. 1907, cooling, refreshing, delicious. That's how Coke was selling then. 1954, Coke's ads read for people on the go. Now, what does that got to do with cool, satisfying, refreshing? 1982, Coke is it. Coke is what? It's it. What do you mean it's it? What is it? It's it. 1986, Red, White, and You, Coca-Cola Classic. Does it taste good? Does it go down smooth? Is it going to give me indigestion and heartburn? What is it? It's it. And it was so effective that they were outselling Pepsi dramatically and continue to do so to this day. And would you like to know what Pepsi's response was? And did Pepsi, as of 1975, say, you guys got it all wrong. It's not about it. It's not about red, white, and blue. It's about taste. Come on, guys, taste it, taste it. That's not what Pepsi was selling. Pepsi began in 1984. Their real major campaign was Pepsi, the choice of a new generation. Now, what in the world does that have to do with the features, the benefits, the taste of Pepsi? The choice of a new generation? Because that's an image. If you want to be a Generation X, if you want to be young, you want to be with it, you have to drink the drink of the new generation. But that's image, prestige. It has nothing to do with the features, nothing to do with the benefit. Now, what I consider the landmark study that really brings this point out was something that was conducted in 2004 and was written about in a journal called Neuron. A certain Dr. Reed Montaug, who is the director of the Brown Human Neuroimaging Lab, it's basically in a Baylor College of Medicine, which is a well-established medical college, he did the following study. He asked people whether they preferred the drink on the left or the drink on the right. He did the typical Pepsi challenge with 67 participants. He found invariably that without markings, people preferred Pepsi over Coke. He then did the same study, but this time put a can of Coke next to the Coke, and put a can of Pepsi next to the sample of Pepsi, asked people again the same question. He found 3/4 of the people preferred the Coke. But here's the interesting part. He then hooked up the participants to a functional MRI. Now, functional MRI measures the brain activity, and here's what he found. When he did the study without any markings, just the blank cup versus the blank cup, Pepsi invariably won, and a part of the brain that relates and feels pleasure would light up, because clearly Pepsi tasted better, and the pleasure center of the brain responded to it better. Then, when he added the Coke can and the Pepsi can, what he found was an amazing thing. Again, the Pepsi would cause the part of the brain that brings pleasure to light up more, but there was another part of the brain that lit up, the part that governs higher thoughts, the part of the brain that's influenced by personal preference, by culture. That part lit up, and what he found is that when people said that they preferred Coke, that it tasted better to them, even though the pleasure center of the brain responded more vigorously to the Pepsi, once they saw it was Coke, another part of the brain kicked in, and in their taste, they felt Coke was better. Now, that's an astounding study, because what it shows is the effect of culture, cultural influence, that not only does culture affect you, but it will tell you whether it tastes better or not. And the reality is that people would drink Coke, say that it tastes better, because the influence of advertising, the influence of marketing, and to them it tasted better. And I think that is a rather astounding showing of the influence that things have upon us. When you understand that the way things taste to me can be influenced by things like advertising, like marketing, it illustrates well how susceptible we human beings are to influence. And that alone would be an important point and worth thinking about, worth stopping on, worth studying. But what if I were to tell you that our culture, our society, our friends can not just affect tastes, but can affect our entire value system, what we consider important, and what we consider currency worth pursuing, what we consider to be really, really significant in life. And let me give you what I consider an interesting example. It's hard to imagine anything more alluring and appealing to a teenager than having your father become the governor of the state. Now, imagine for a minute that you're 14, 15, 16 years old, and your father becomes the governor. It doesn't get better. Number one, personal chauffeur. Number two, any sports game, any rock concert, front row seats, right there. Your own Secret Service agents, your own private helicopter. You go where you want, when you want. Any celebrity that you wish to meet knows your name, and has all the time in the world for you. It doesn't get better than that. Interestingly enough, Ronald Reagan began his entry into politics when he was in his mid-50s. And in his autobiography, he describes that to his family, this was something new. And in fact, he won the governorship of California at that age. He gathered together with his family when he won the actual election. Three of his children were home, and they all joined together in the victory celebration. His daughter, Patty, who was 14 at the time, was away at school. He called Patty to tell her the good news, and when she picked up the phone and he told her, "I've become the governor of California," she began crying. But they were not tears of joy. She was very distraught, and she was broken. She was very, very upset. And Ronald Reagan explains the reason for it was because she was a child of the 60s. This was 1966 when he won that election. And his daughter was a student of the time. She became enamored with that anti-establishment dogma. She became an anti-establishment person. And the thought that her own father, who was a turncoat, her own father became part of the establishment, was so abhorrent to her that she began crying. Had her father become some beatnik hippie driving a beat-up old Volkswagen minibus wearing tattered jeans, she would have been much happier. But the thought that her father was now part of government sickened her. And that's very interesting, because to any regular teenager in any other time, it would have been a cause of celebration. But the reality is that we human beings are greatly affected by the culture, by the times, by the people amongst whom we live. We are greatly influenced by others. Our mindset, Our value system, our currency, is shaped by society and people's views. And I think that that's actually the answer for Kalev. You see, Kalev was a very wise individual. And he knew that the men amongst whom he was walking were not simple people. They were, as the Pasuk said, Kula Manoshim, all people, says Rashi, all very great people. Roshi B'nai Yisrael Hema, they were leaders of the Klai Yisrael. He was not going out with 10 other regular people. They were great people. They were people of stature. And he understood that they would have an influence upon him. There'd be a long discussion. It would be a back and forth. When they walked into the land, and they would, when they would be filled with fear, when they would see these giants and they would begin shaking, Kalev understood that it would influence him, it would affect him, and he was afraid that it would change him, take away his betochen, and take away the clarity of thought, and he was afraid. So afraid that it was mispalel, please, avos, intercede, please beg Hashem for mercy that I should not be affected. Believe me, Kalev was not neurotic, he was not paranoid, he was a very wise, intelligent person who understood the danger, understood what was at risk, and understood how much a small group can influence him, how his chaverim, how his peer group could change his mindset, and because of that, he understood the grave danger. And I think it's a very interesting illustration that even when you know it's wrong, even when you know the gravity of the situation, even if your name is Kalev ben Yefuneh and you know that this decision will lead to the death of yourself, the generation, maybe changing history, you could be influenced by others, you could be influenced by your peer group, you could change your mind, lose your clarity of thought, and make a wrong decision. And this, to me, is a very interesting illustration of how susceptible we humans are to others' values, others' opinions, and how careful we have to be in terms of choosing our friends. Now, the reason why this is particularly nogea to our discussion now is because we're in a three-part series that deals with the issue called change. The last shmooze, we discussed some elements of change, and I'd like to highlight another little point of that today. And let me begin with something that wasn't discussed last time. We did mention the fact that there are many smokers in this country. As a matter of fact, 44.5 million people in this country are smokers. We also mentioned last shmooze that of those 44.5 million, 10 million deny any adverse health effects from smoking. Meaning, if you will go over to 10 million of that group, almost a quarter of the group of smokers, adult smokers in this country, and ask them, what are you doing? Don't you know that's bad for your health? They'll look at you askance, they'll look at you funny and say, what are you talking about? You believe that nonsense? However, there is an additional 34.5 million who do understand that smoking is damaging, bad, will link to lung cancer, emphysema, all types of medical issues. Here's the next interesting statistic. Of those 34.5 million, 70% wish they could quit. 35% of those millions of people try to quit. Of those, only 5%, even less than 5%, succeed. Meaning, despite the fact they know that this is killing them, despite the fact that they know there are many, many adverse health effects, despite all of that, less than 5% of smokers successfully quit. And what this illustrates is the fact that change is not so simple. Even when you get it, even when you know that this is damaging, will take away my breath, take away my longevity, take away my health, it's very difficult to change a habit. And we discussed the fact that we as B'nai Torah have a major mandate to change. The Gra and Evan Shlema opens up by saying all of Avodas Hashem is dependent on Tikkun HaMidos, on changing. And he says, Im lav kein, if you're not doing that, lama lo chayim, why should you have life? And that demand to change covers the gamut of all activities. But the problem is, if change is so difficult, and we're mandated to change in not just bad habits, but throughout all of our activities, and that means my midos, whether it be anger, jealousy, competitiveness, humility, learning, dominating, what type of husband I am, what type of father I am, the entire essence of who I am, I'm obligated to change. The question is, how do I succeed? And we mentioned in the last Shmooze that there are five stages of change. The first stage being denial, where the person denies the problem. The typical alcoholic does not say, yes, I'm a drunk, and I wish I could change. The typical drunk is not a drunk. He doesn't have a problem. It's his wife has a problem, his boss has a problem, his kids have the problem, not he. The next stage is getting it. The next stage is preparing a plan. Then it's taking action and maintenance. And here's the point that I think I really want to bring out. When you leave the stage of denial, and you get it, and you understand that a given activity is bad for you, whether it be drug abuse, whether it be nicotine, whether it be overeating, whether it be gambling, you're now at the point that you're ready to take action. What you have to understand is to succeed, you need many, many tools. The first tool that you need is a very powerful motivation. And your culture will tremendously affect your motivation. If you are amongst people who do not value what you value, if you're amongst people who devalue what you consider important, you will have a great problem being motivated, and you'll have a great problem staying motivated. And my friend, that has very real relevance to us. Because if you live in a community that's materialistically competitive, if you live in a community whose value system is based on how much money he's worth, how much money he makes, how much money he has, or more, how much money he spends, that will influence you. That will shape you, that will shape your motivation, that will shape your currency, it will shape the way you view things, and that's a very important thing to know, recognize, and understand. One of the things that we discussed at the Shabbaton was that one of the goals of TBT is to attempt to create our own community. And our own community means groups of like-minded people who share goals, who share interests, who share common currency. Because if you create your own infrastructure in your own community, then you share the same value systems. But if you don't do that and you're out in the wild, then you're greatly affected by the way people do things. This is a male audience, I could say this comfortably. And the way many, many frum, good women dress today is absolutely unacceptable. Many a time my wife has said to me, such and such woman, who is a chashuv woman, is dressed disgustingly. The clothing are either way too tight, way too revealing, or just inappropriate for a Bas Yisrael. But I'm talking about good women who understand better, and yet they dress in a way that's very inappropriate. And there's only one reason. Because that's the world. Everyone dresses that way. A woman wants to feel attractive. Since my community and everybody in my community dresses that way, if I don't dress that way, I'm going to be out of it. When a girl grows up and she goes from being an innocent little girl to becoming a teenager, and then she starts speaking about the fact that she wants clothing that shows a bit more form, not so loose, something that shows the figure a bit more, what she's saying is the women she's exposed to, the older girls that she's around, wear tight clothing. That has gotten the allure, the appeal of being attractive. She wants that because her community values that. The people amongst whom she associates dress that way. That's attractive to her. She wishes to be attractive. And the community, the friends, set the currency. And understanding that is very important, understanding how one can succeed in life. Because if you live amongst people who have values that are different than yours, or different than the Torah, they will affect you. If you live amongst people who money spells success, honor, how big the house is, how fancy the car is, what type of clothing they wear, if that's the formula for success, if you associate long enough, deal with these type of people enough, it will shape your own currency, will change your mindset, and therefore, I think it's very important to have groups, whether it be shuls, whether it be organizations, in our case, Teferet Nei Torah, as an organization, to create a social structure that will allow us to create our own value system, not value system from outside. And that's an important reason to have a chevra, a small community where you can create the value systems and currency that are significant. But I think there's another reason. Another reason was something that was well illustrated to me when I was living in Rochester, New York. There's a friend of mine there whose name is Doc Groskin. Now, Doc Groskin was mentioned once in a schmooze because Doc Groskin is physically one of the strongest individuals I know. I've watched Doc Groskin put over 600 pounds on a bar, go down, go up, go down, go up. I watched the bar bend over his shoulders, but Doc kept doing his squats like there was not much on his back. And the reason why Doc Groskin is nogea to this conversation this evening is for a very simple point. What I discovered was we were good friends, and on a regular basis, whenever he'd be working on a new record, he would tell me about it. Well, I'm trying to bench such and such weight, I'm looking to squat 600 pounds, and invariably the weeks that would lead up to it, he would tell me about it, I would comment back and forth, and I later discovered that I was not the only one that he shared this with. Now, Doc is a very humble guy, and at the time it didn't make sense to me, and only later did I discover what he was doing. What he was doing was creating his own mini support group. You see, when I would say to him, "Hey Doc, 2 weeks to the contest, how you doing? You ready?" That gave him chizik. And then when he'd go to somebody else, and another person, he's saying it, they're responding. He was creating his own support group for his goals, which in that case was setting certain records. But that, you sowed, my friends, is part and parcel of every successful self-changer. Any person who becomes successful at change understands the importance of support groups. The reason why there are 1 million 12-step programs in this country is because they work. If you're an alcoholic and you go to Alcoholics Anonymous, forget the program, forget the willpower, forget the techniques. The fact that you're in a group and the group gives you chizik and you speak, they speak, you're part of a small community, that makes the difference of whether you're successful or not. And even if you say, well, I'm not into that sort of thing, communities, groups, I don't do that thing, here's a Weight Watchers statistic. Weight Watchers discovered that people who attend meetings will lose on average 3 times as much weight. Meaning, 2 people, one person follows a diet, the other person follows a diet but also goes to meetings. The people who also go to meetings will lose on average 3 times as much weight as the people who don't. No difference in motivation, no difference in willpower, no difference in the plan. The only difference is when you go there once a week and it's a social group and they're machazik you, you're machazik them, together you're in this, there's a sense of community, and the difference is you're 3 times as likely to be successful. And that sort of thing is very, very key to understanding if you would like to grow. If you would like to do the difficult task of growing, whether it's because you have a particular habit that you wish to change, or because you're a Jew and the mandate of a Jew is to grow, to change, to improve, then understanding that creating your own chabura, whether it be 2 guys, 3 guys, 10 guys, a small community, large community, setting up groups, setting up small individualized people who come together for the same purpose will make a dramatic difference in whether you're successful or not. And understanding that is a tremendous step in understanding what's needed to change. I think there's a very, very key lesson to learn from Kalev. Kalev was a pikeach, a very wise man. What Kalev understood was not that he was questioning his own judgment. He knew with absolute clarity of thought that what Meraglim were doing was tantamount to suicide. They were rebelling against Hashem. They were trying to lead a generation into heresy. They were trying to lead a generation to its death. He knew that. But he also knew the influence of others. He also understood how much he's affected. He didn't study the Kola War, but the reality of that point is that whether I think Pepsi or Coke tastes good, not whether I prefer it, but whether it tastes good to me, can be manipulated, can be changed by advertising. When the MRI is hooked up, it clearly shows the pleasure center responds higher, but there's another part of my brain that kicks in and tells me Coke tastes better. If that part of me, how I taste, can be influenced, can be so easily manipulated. How much more so the culture, the society we live in manipulates us, affects us. Patty Reagan is a classic example. When a teenage girl begins crying because her father becomes a governor, because she's so steeped into the culture, the counterculture revolution of the 60s, that she looks at government as the ultimate evil, that's because the society, the people we live in, influences, affects us, and Kalev understood that. He understood that right now he gets it, right now he understands the danger, but it's going to be a few weeks, it's going to be 40 days, there are going to be discussions, they're wise people, they're going to influence me, and he understood the danger. Hence he was Mespalel Hashem, please have rachamim. And understanding the influence of society helps us in two levels. Number one, in terms of setting my currency. Once I understand the amount that other people, their values, their currency can shape mine, I choose my community very carefully. I'm very careful what shul I choose to daven in. I'm very careful what organizations I belong to, because I understand the influence is very subtle but very real. The very things that I value, the very things that I consider important, can be changed by the block, by the community, by the shul that I daven in. And it's very important to have organizations, to have groups that allow us to create our own culture, our own value systems, which are real. And the second point, which is equally significant, is understanding that if I wish to change, and I wish to change because that's what being a firm Jew is about, growing, changing, whether it be in midos, in davening, in avodas Hashem, in any area, whether it be getting rid of a bad habit or working on anything, I have to know the techniques and the systems and the stages of change. Once I know that my currency, my value system is shaped by my friends, and I know that motivationally it's very important for me to have the right type of friends. But once I understand that how it functions, I also understand the value and significance of support groups. Support groups can be formal, can be informal, it can be anything as informal as having a friend with whom you share the fact that you're trying to work on an issue, whether it be a midah, whether it be learning, whether it be davening. Whether it actually be a group that you get together more formally, 10 people, 3 people, 8 people. But understanding the importance of that, and understanding that the difference spells a huge difference in success. If you want to lose weight, 3 times as much weight is lost attending meetings. Same techniques, same willpower, same diet, but having that social group allows you to change more. And again, if our goal is ultimately changing, understanding the systems and the support systems needed is very significant. I want to close with an interesting point that's brought in the Sefer Todah that I think well illustrates this concept. In the 35th parak, the Sefer Todah says as follows. It brings down a certain maisa that happened with Rav Sadia Gaon. Apparently a Talmud of Rav Sadia Gaon came unexpected one late night and found his Rebbe, Rav Sadia Gaon, rolling in the snow. The Talmud was aghast, because that's the type of thing that if you're a major chote, if you did some major avera, there are certain times when you self-inflicted isurim, etc. It certainly didn't fit the image of Rav Sadia Gaon. He said, Rebbe, with all due respect, does Rav Sadia Gaon have to do this type of thing, rolling in the snow? Rav Sadia Gaon said, no, do not make a mistake. I did not do any avera that's severe enough to warrant this, but I'll explain to you why I'm doing this. And Rav Sadia Gaon went on to explain. He said, not long ago, I went to a certain town, and I asked a person there, a balabas, to put me up in his home. The man didn't know who I was, but he's very gracious, and he gave me a bed, and he gave me food. Well, after a little while, the word began spreading in town that Rav Sadia Gaon was there, and the whole town converged on the house, and this balabas who had put me up already for a little while understood who I was, and he runs in and he says, "Oi, Rebbe, I didn't treat you with the right kavod." From that moment on, he gave me kavod malachim, the best food, the best housing, the best bed, and everything I needed. He waited on me hand and foot. And as I was leaving, he comes over to me and he, on both knees, he begs mechila with tears in his eyes and says, "Rebbe, forgive me. Rebbe, forgive me." I said, "What do you have to ask mechila for? You treated me beautifully, both originally and now. What do you have to ask mechila?" I said, "No. I have to ask Mechila because the first few days when you stayed by me, I didn't know who you were, and I didn't treat you with the right covet. Please forgive me for that. Sadigon said, you're forgiven, you're forgiven. And then Sadigon said to himself as follows, I now am very different than I was 20 years ago. I daven with a very different sense. I appreciate Hashem now with a much greater sense. I have much more reverence for Hashem, much more yira, much more love. And what that means is I act to Hashem now very differently than I did 20 years ago. But what that means is 20 years ago, I wasn't acting the right way. And therefore I need tshuva, I need kapara, therefore I roll in the snow to ask Hashem forgiveness to be mochel me for that which I did. And gentlemen, that's a major, major lesson. And that lesson is that Rav Sadia Gaon, as great as he was at 20, was far greater at 40, far greater at 60, and that's a very significant question that a person has to ask himself. At my age right now, where I'm standing, if I look back 5 years ago, am I significantly different? And I don't mean that I make more money than spend more money. Am I as a human being? Am I as a mensch? Am I as a balmidos? Am I as a thinking, caring human being significantly different? And the answer has to be yes. Because as the Gross says, Im lav kein lama lo chayim, what did you need those years of life for? The purpose of life, those years that are given to us, are to change, to mold myself, to make myself into a different human being. And if I look at myself now, and look back at myself at my bar mitzvah, and I say I'm not much different other than a little bit older, what that means is that entire time period was empty, for vain, was for naught. And understanding the need to change, and understanding that milestones in life are marking points that a person should look back upon and say, I'm radically different, I'm not the same person, is a measure of the man and a measure of life. But to change, a person needs motivation. And to change, a person needs techniques. To change, a person needs to understand the process. Motivationally, having the right chavirim, having the right friends, having the right seviva creates the atmosphere. Technique-wise, understanding what's needed to change, understanding need for plans, understanding the need for a support system ultimately helps a person successfully maintain that change. May Hashem give us the wisdom, understanding, and ability to put this into practice.
You've been listening to The Shmooze, presented by Teferis B'nai Torah. For more information on The Shmooze, please visit us at www.theshmooze.com, where you can download all The Shmoozin' free of charge, as well as view source sheets and address questions or comments on this or any other Shmooze. The Shmooze is completely funded by private donations. We need your help to continue our work. All donations are tax-deductible and count as miser. Please help us help others by calling 866-613-TORAH. That's 866-613-TORAH. Or you can make your donation right on the web at www.theshmooze.com.